Hey, this is Macy Gray, and you are listening to OC Caravan with Scott Hayes and Jim Bass. Come on.
All right. You're listening to KX93.5. Laguna's only FM. I'm Scott Hayes, and this, of course, is Radio Caravan. Jim, what's going on in this world?
Well, today,
yeah,
just because, I was looking up and driving in from Laguna Canyon Road, and they said there's going to be a lot of traffic today.
Right.
The city's basically going to be shut down because today's Patriots Day in Laguna Beach, and they have an annual parade. They've been doing it for over 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
It starts up by the high school, goes down through on Park, down Glenier, and then up to Forest, and
right.
Ends up at the City Hall. Big deal. They've been doing it for a long time. This year's Grand Marshal is Olympic swimmer Janet Evans.
You
might remember her, right?
Sure, of course. Newport Beach.
She's in there. Yeah, no, actually.
Or Laguna Beach? Maybe it's Laguna, I guess.
I think she went to El Dorado High School, if remember correctly,
uh-huh.
Out in Placentia. But anyway, so she's the Grand Marshal. They've been doing it. They're going to honor World War II veterans and everybody who served our country, and it's kind of a big deal.
It's always fun to go and sit down there and kind of grab your seat. You got to get down there early, of course, to grab a good seat. And I think KX93.5 is part of that parade as well. I don't know if they're taking that car downstairs. And is this the parade? Anybody know? April, you may know. You kind of some of the crew may know here. Is this the parade where the guys, the old Western guys with the guns, come and they have the shootout in the middle of the street? You know?
I don't think
anybody know if that's it? No? Doesn't ring a bell? Okay, maybe it's the wrong parade then. Okay.
San Juan does stuff like that.
Okay, there you go. That's
horses
it.
The Swallows Day Parade.
No, they do it down here. I've been down here when they've done that before. So, okay. No, I don't think so, April. But thank you for that. That's April, our engineer. Hey, also, anything else going on, Jim?
Oh, there's always something going on, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. Also in the studio, we have Kieran Muise.
Good morning.
What's her title we gave you, Kieran?
Reporter. Arts and culture reporter.
Arts and culture reporter.
Editor. Wow. Arts and culture editor.
There. Editor.
Hey, whatever floats.
Okay.
Floats your boat.
And we haven't had you in for a couple of weeks.
Couple of weeks, yeah. And
you're doing well?
Doing great. Had a little incident where the 605 was blocked off and I didn't get home till 3 a.m.
Right.
Coming from the LA, LAX. That was the 405, actually,
if
and I ended up on the 605.
If you get stuck in that, it's brutal.
Oh,
it's happened to me a lot.
Oh, I couldn't believe it, and I just was, like, kicking myself, like, darn
yeah.
it.
It does. Well, it takes about 2 to 3 hours to get home. Just because they
I
take
took
you
side
through,
streets.
Well, they take you out to Seal Beach, and then they run you on the coast, and it's just a nightmare.
Yeah, so thankfully I was like, okay, I always know where south is because that's where the ocean is. So just go there.
Easy enough. PCH yeah.
And I'll find my way home. But I'm glad to be back and getting everyone up to speed this morning.
Cool. Well, what are we up to speed on this morning?
Up to speed this morning, I'm focusing on the Irvine Museum today.
Nice.
IrvineMuseum.org, for those who don't know the website address, they have a exhibition on 19th century art. And it's titled California, This Golden Land of Promise.
Hmm.
And I really like this exhibition. I selected this specifically for the Up to Speed segment because I'm a very nostalgic person.
Mm-hmm.
And the paintings featured are historic Spanish missions and landscapes. And one of the artists is William Hahn. He created a painting that is being shown called Mexican Cattle Drivers in Southern California. Huh. And this painting's dated 1883. And, you know, he's known for detailed genre scenes. He died in 1887, so he did this a couple of years before his death. And me being an artist, I know what that means. And he, you know, to paint this in plein air, which in French translates to open air,
right.
You know, so he's out there, he's on a site, on location. And I'm not a plein air artist, but I know plein air artists. I've taken a couple of classes. It's an extremely challenging form of artwork,
sure.
To capture things as they're happening.
Yeah.
And, so I really like the fact that the Irvine Museum is focusing on him, as well as Alexander Harmer, who has a painting of the mission in San Juan Capistrano. And I've actually never seen this mission. So after seeing the exhibition, I know I'm right here. It's in
the
backyard.
Yeah, you got to go.
So now I'm going to go see the art. And what that the point that this brings me to is, you know, plein air artists and how they fit in our current society. Like, I remember before I moved to Paris that PCH, you know, what is now this huge shopping center in Crystal Cove and all these homes that are built where you have, you know, a lot of people living. That just used to be hills. And I remember coming back and just being kind of devastated that the landscape, you know, was, it was now a real estate haven. And I understood, you know, the economics behind that. But I just hope someone captured that. I hope someone sat out there and, yeah, and kind of painted that landscape. And on a personal note, you know, knowing a lot of plein air artists, I have to say some of the best artists, coincidentally, and which may be a surprise, some of the best plein air artists I know started in tattooing. You know, so I think just that eye to have the precision, the depth, it's just, it's real remarkable.
That's, you know, interesting.
And I think a lot of people, you know, wouldn't necessarily connect the two.
Right.
But I've seen that. And just to shed a little bit of an insider, you know, viewpoint and perspective on that. So go to the Irvine Museum. The exhibition's on till the end of the month. California, this golden land of promise. If you're as nostalgic as I am and want to kind of have a glimpse of life, you know, before we, you know, before Orange County became what it is today,
yeah,
it's definitely a go-to.
Give that website again.
It's irvinemuseum.org. This is Kieran Uys getting you up to speed, Orange County. Be you for you.
Up to speed. That's what I was trying to remember. Beautiful. You know, Jim, you didn't grow up in California, right?
I lived here.
You moved out?
I was 10.
When you were 10? Okay.
I was 10, yeah.
So you probably remember going down PCH. And off to the left there, you'd go down to the beach, you'd be able to ride horses down,
yeah,
there.
Really?
Oh, sure, yeah, a long time ago. People would go and, yeah, rent those horses and ride them up and down the beach, et cetera. And by the way, have you ever been to the Mission in Santa Barbara?
Yes.
And have you ever seen that chalk event that,
yes,
they do?
Yes.
That's amazing.
I actually had a friend. I was fortunate enough, and about, I want to say it was like last year or the year before, he flew us in his plane, and uh-huh, we went, and it was so gorgeous, the amount of detail, and they're actually, you know, they're still working on a lot of the pieces, yeah, and I know they're putting in all this time and energy, and it's just going to get washed away. You,
right,
know?
Eventually it gets,
yeah,
washed away.
Yeah, they let the rain naturally do its thing. They don't deliberately or intentionally remove the artwork, because, yeah, that was one of the questions I asked. And they got a lot of jazz musicians, and it's just a
That's
great
cool,
environment,
man.
Great
really
event.
Cool,
yeah, I mean, for people who don't know, it's Santa Barbara. It's the Mission in Santa Barbara. I don't know what time of year they do this. I don't recall, but they have these plots sort of set out for people to come, and with chalk,
yes,
colored chalk, they create these incredible pieces of art.
Oh, yes, they're extraordinary.
And they're transitional, of course, because as the rain comes, it washes it all away. All right, Miss Kieran, thank you very much. Very kind of you to come in this morning. Jim, anything else? We've got a great guest coming in, by the way. I've really been looking forward to this opportunity to interview gang intervention specialist Professor Al Valdez, and it's going to be a compelling, passionate story on so many levels and very relevant to today's world. Any other thoughts, Jim, right now in terms of anything you'd want to talk about before we take a musical break and bring in Professor Valdez?
I was just looking up the Santa Barbara thing. It's May 23rd, 24th, and 25th.
Look at you.
It's their 29th anniversary. It's called the Madonari Italian Street Painting Festival. That's what they do in Santa Barbara.
That's a couple of
there
months.
There it is.
Yeah, April. Well, that's a few months away. So there you go, Jim. Thanks,
yep,
for doing
I was just looking at, you know, these amazing things that we have.
What are those called, by the way?
It's a magic machine.
A magic machine.
Yeah.
Is that the technical term for it?
It is.
And just a reminder to listeners, it's the parade today. So if you're thinking of going downtown, driving through town, parking, it may be a bit of a challenge for people.
So. South Lagoon is probably a good place to be if you just want to hang out.
Yeah.
If you want to go to the parade, then
do that.
Go early and park.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay, you're listening to KX93.5 Laguna's Only FM. I'm Scott Hayes. This is OC Caravan. We're going to take a one-minute musical break. We're coming back, and we're going to have a long, extended conversation with gang intervention specialist Al Valdez. April, a little music, please.
Promise. when you lower me down so deep that I can't get out, and when you're lost and alone, yes, you'd think it was a last place, you come back for more. If you don't want me to leave, then don't push me away. Rather blow out the lights, you can't watch it all fade. But I'm going nowhere, I'm gonna stay. When you just wanna fight, when you're closing your eyes, 'cause you don't wanna love me, I'm gonna stay. You can't push me too far, there's no space in my heart where I don't wanna love. When there's no, no, storm, and how can I feel the calm? If there's nothing, nothing, nothing left to lose, then what is this feeling? Keeps on bringing me back to you. So I'm gonna stay. When you just wanna fight, then you're closing your eyes, 'cause you don't wanna love.
You're listening to KX93.5, Laguna's Only FM. I'm Scott Hayes, here with my co-host Jim Bastian, and this, of course, is OC Caravan. And in the studio this morning, we have gang intervention specialist Professor Al Valdez, who's also a professor over at UCI. And Al has more than 28 years of law enforcement experience. He's a former Orange County District Attorney and gang investigator. He's a professor, as I just mentioned, over at UCI, and he has trained thousands of police officers, attorneys, parents, teachers, and students on gang sociology and psychology. How'd I do?
You did great.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
A pretty impressive CV, right?
Absolutely.
So welcome, by the way, and thanks for coming in. I know you drove in from about a 50-minute drive, so
yeah.
Thank you for that. It's a bit of a drive.
My privilege. Morning. Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to start, you know, there's so much we want to get to. There's so much we want to get to in terms of, you know, your expertise in gang intervention, the books you've written, some things that are going on right now today in the last few weeks with one of your co-authors, et cetera. But I wanted to start by giving listeners and viewers a sense of your background. And so I'm wondering if you could describe for us sort of first-generation Latino and what it was like growing up in California.
Well, as I tell my students, I come from a very humble background. Mm-hmm. I was born in Northern California and was very poor. Not that my parents didn't care about us, but my dad worked about three jobs to hold us down and keep mom at home. And I worked the fields with my cousins. We went to bed hungry a few times, woke up hungry a few times. A tough life.
Right. Now, you said you worked the fields. At what age were you working the fields?
10, 11, 12 years old, getting up at 3 in the morning, picking tomatoes, picking fruit, working on the farms. It was a way to make a living. My sons think it's really funny. In the house I grew up, we did not have a toilet. And so we had a three-pound coffee can that about 12 people shared, and if it was your turn to empty it in the morning, that was a terrible, terrible duty.
I'm sure.
And the first time we got a toilet, it was on the outside of my grandmother's house where we lived, and three homes shared it. And we had never seen the water twirl or where it would go because it was a brand new thing. We would just flush the toilet to see where the water would go. We couldn't figure out. It was magic for us at the time. And that's how naive we grew up in sort of a very rural area in Northern California.
So what sort of lessons does one learn growing up in that environment? You lived in poverty on dirt roads. I sort of tracked this down a little bit online. You had to steal food. I think you even admit you had to steal food a few
times.
Yeah,
we did.
To feed
we
your
hungry.
Family. You had to repair your shoes with cardboard and duct tape.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, as growing up in that environment...
You learn to survive. You learn to work with the things you have. You get a great work ethic, and you learn not to be afraid of what I call sweat equity. There's nothing wrong with working hard. My parents always told us to go to school. No matter how poor we are, we always had a bar of soap. Poverty doesn't give you an excuse to be rude, angry, or dirty. I didn't have new clothes, but they were mended, and we looked neat. Poverty is used as a crutch today, in my opinion, for many people to say, well, woe is me, and I'm never going to get out. You can survive. It's a very difficult life. Mm-hmm. But it taught me a good work ethic. It taught me, as my bride would call it, to be a workaholic. She thinks I'm a workaholic. But I'm not afraid to tackle anything. I'm not afraid to ask for anything, and I'm certainly not afraid to work hard.
So tell us about your background from then forward, education, schooling. How'd you get out of the field?
My dad, who was in the Air Force at the time, well, bless his soul, bought a house in Buena Park, and we still stayed up north with my grandmother, and he worked three jobs to pay for that house, and he worked two and three jobs my entire life so my mom could stay home with my brothers and sisters and I. And albeit we were poor, we were sort of middle-income poor. And my dad always provided food once we moved down here. My parents, my mom did all kind of side works, clean buildings, clean toilets. I went with her a couple of times. We went on a cleaning crew. Earn extra money to put my brother and sister and I in a Catholic school, St. Pius V in Orange County. And we went to this private parochial school. I learned there the value of education, and my parents really enforced the value of education. I think that's pivotal to my success. My mom and dad always said, you're going to go to college, you need to be something, and you have to do what you have to do. In eighth grade, Servite High School came by, and we heard about this all-boys parochial college prep school, and I wanted to go to college. My initial goal was to be a medical doctor, and I wanted to go to that school. But it was $683 a year at the time in 1968, and my parents could not afford it. So at 12 years old, I lied in an application and got hired at Albertsons in Buena Park and made $1.72 an hour. It cost me $60 to join the retail clerks union. Minimum wage at the time was $1.25, so I was styling at the time, right? $1.72 an hour. And I rode my two-wheel bike to work through the summer in rain or at night, whatever it was, and I put myself through Servite High School and 5 years of college at UCI by working. I've been on my own financially since I was 13. Not because my parents didn't love me, but because they just couldn't afford it. And that's what poverty does. It teaches you to step up. It teaches you to think outside the box and break some rules. Not break the law, but break some rules.
So how then does one gravitate toward becoming a gang intervention specialist?
Totally by accident. Early on, I wanted my... I've been married twice. So my first wife was... high school graduate. I encouraged her to go to community college. We went to Cypress College. She was taking Spanish. I spoke Spanish. And the only class that was available at the time was something called Introduction to Law Enforcement. And I don't know why this is so vivid. There was a gentleman named Lieutenant Norm Cook. He was an Irish guy. He had a stogie cigar, and he taught this class in Introduction to Law Enforcement. And mind you, I've only had science and math for 5 years, science and math. And I loved the sciences, loved the math. But I was totally intrigued by this guy, and I'm in with high school graduates in a community college, and I have two bachelor's degrees. And I'm acing his exams, I'm writing all the stuff up, I'm reading ahead, and one day after class he comes up and puts his hand really heavily on my left shoulder and goes, who in the hell are you? And I go, I don't understand you, sir. He goes, who are you? Are you from the police department? Are you spying on me? And I stood up and I moved his hand away. I go, I don't know what you're talking about. And I told him what I just related. He looks at me and says, you should be a cop. I go, are you crazy? I'm a scientist. I'm employed as a chemical engineer at Hughes Aircraft at the time. Are you nuts? I'm a scientist. He goes, no, you have what it takes. You've got moxie. You're a good size. You write really well. You're educated. Let me buy you lunch. So the next week, at my lunch hour, I went to this lieutenant, and he bought me a hamburger at Carl's Jr.'s across the police department. And 3 months later, I was in the Reserve Police Academy here in Saddleback College, graduating as the Academy President and number one in the class. And this is what I tell my students, because this is the truth. The first time I went to train with the police department after graduating, and the first time I sat in the car in the passenger seat with my uniform on and my partner, training cop, I felt like I was at home. There was some overwhelming feeling that this had to be it. And I struggled with that because my academic training is for the sciences. I was reserve for a couple of years, made reserve police officer of the year, and made the decision to go full-time with Anaheim. Upset my parents, especially my dad, because he thought at first I was going to not use my education. Went full-time, and I went from making several thousand dollars a month to $889 a month as a rookie cop. But I have to tell you, 28-plus years has gone by like 30 seconds. I never went to work. I went to go play. And I knew I had a tremendous responsibility as a police officer. My training officers are really good at Anaheim to say that we work for the community. We work with the community and for the community. They are our clients. And yes, you have to do a job. You have to arrest people. You have to use violence sometimes. And hopefully you never have to use deadly violence. But don't be afraid, because you have to go home the same way you came to work, in one piece. We work for the community. We provide public safety. And that was drummed into me at the time. And I worked graveyard for 7 years and loved every minute of it. And then I went undercover narcotics and worked narcotics here. And then went to the DA's office. And I got into gangs by accident. The old DA, Mike Capizzi, at the time formed a gang unit back in the 90s. And I got assigned to it. And I was kind of thrown into it. But it was a unique experience. My undercover ability and undercover experience allowed me to communicate really well with gang members. I had a knack for doing homicide investigations, and one thing led to another, and I got asked to teach a four-hour class because the gang expert at the county at the time was sick, and I jumped in for him and prepared a class, and that was like 25 years ago, and I haven't stopped teaching since.
So during that time period, did you continue your education?
No. I had a family, got remarried, and I'm blessed with five sons who are all doing okay. And I took care of them and took care of the family. And I started my graduate work my last 6 years as a DA investigator. I had no life for 6 years, and you can ask my family. I didn't attend parties. I've missed anniversaries and birthdays and makeup dates. And what happens after makeup dates, because I was studying. And four or five nights a month, I'd go without sleep because I had homework to do. And I put the kids to bed and mama to bed, and it's 10 o'clock at night, and I've got two papers to write. And next thing you know, it's 5:30 in the morning. I shower and shave and go to work with no sleep. It was the hardest thing that I'd ever done in my life. And I have to tell you, halfway through the graduate program, I was going to quit. But if it wasn't for a professor from SC, Malcolm Klein, who's a colleague, he gave me a... He doesn't realize it, but he gave me like a father-son pep talk. And he brought me lunch. I had lunch with him at SCU once, and I was complaining and whining. Oh, woe is me. You know, I have no sleep. I'm not going to get this through. The readings, the papers. Oh, my God, the pressure. He told me to take one day at a time, that there's light at the end of the tunnel, and I listened to him. And when I graduated, I was so tired, I never went to the formal graduation. I had my diploma that was mailed to me on my desk unopened for about a month before I really realized what I had done, that less than 2% of the world's population have a PhD, and that was a tremendous accomplishment. And it took a while to really fathom what had done, because I was still working.
What was your goal at the time when you went to get the PhD? What did you think you were going to do with it?
Well, here's the plan for my bride and I had was I wanted to be a psychologist. My wife and I had very good communication skills, and we talked about opening up a speakeasy. She's a retired trauma nurse. I thought I was going to be a psychologist, but in my clinical trainings a little bit, I realized that being a policeman for about 30 years kind of taints you. And growing up poor, I don't like whiners. And to help people, sometimes you have to listen to them whine. And I didn't think my personality had me set, because I don't think it's a very good therapeutic modality to tell somebody to get the H-E double holly hockey sticks out of your office, go fix it because you're whining. That's not good. So I went into teaching, and I used my psychology training to help me understand gang behaviors, which has really opened up a whole world to me. Because I, growing up poor, you look at things different. My friends graduated from high school. Their parents were buying them brand new cars and sending them to Europe for 3 months and paying for their college. And my old man gave me permission to buy a car. That was my graduation present. So I look at the world a little bit differently. And my old man, bless his soul, he wasn't being mean or angry. That's just the way it was back in the day. And I look at things differently. I like people who work. I like people who like to head problems head on. And let's be smart about it. Let's not butt our head against the wall. If we have to, let's go around it or underneath it. That's what education does. That's the value of education.
So let's talk a little bit about the gang problem in this country, and maybe we can hone it down a little bit more further to the gang problem here in Southern California. Can you speak to that issue and what we're facing and why young men, and I'm assuming women, gravitate toward that lifestyle?
Yeah, our country has over 1 million gang members, certified gang members, and I think that number is a little bit low. And one of the reasons is there's no standard definition for what is a gang or what is a street gang. Everybody has a different. The feds have a different one. State by state have different definitions. So you can't triage it correctly. If we were all medical doctors and I said we have a fracture of the left epiphysis on the left femur, you all know exactly where that's at because the epiphysis is at the bottom part of the bone. It's a lateral fracture across. It's a left femur. It's geographically, we know where that is. We don't have that in the world of gangs. I mean, in the countries I visit to, Mexico has a different definition. The countries of Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala have different definitions. Our school district has a different definition. There's a definition in the penal code that people
How do you define it?
Well, it's a group of three or more with a common identifier, and they're involved in crime. Mm-hmm. And the fourth criteria is that they're an association. That's a gang. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying they're a criminal street gang because gangs are different. I mean, the tagging crews we have in Orange County here are gangs. Mm-hmm. They fit that academic definition. But are they like MS-13 that goes and beheads people and cut up babies in Central America? No, they're not that type of gang, but they're still a gang. So the gang activity varies, and that's what separates. That criminal activity is really what differentiates the gangs that the police work with.
So how big is the criminal activity perpetuated by the gangs, and who would you say are some of the more notorious gangs in this community?
The latest research tells us it depends on where you go in the country. Some parts of the country, gang-related activity accounts for about 75-80% of the crime. Other parts of the country can be as high as 40%. And gangs aren't active all the time. So the crime kind of fluctuates in hills and valleys. If we had to say who's the world's most dangerous gang or who's the country's most dangerous gang, you can't, because one gang will be very active for 7-8 months and they'll be considered the most active. And then the second gang, they'll disappear because their conflict's over and another gang will take over. The media has really highlighted two major gangs in the country, MS-13 and 18th Street.
Now, can you define those two gangs?
Yeah, MS-13 is called Mara Salvatrucha. They were formed with the El Salvadorian immigrants that migrated to Southern California in the late 80s. Early 80s, late 80s. And they ended up residing in the old Rampart, Belvedere section, MacArthur Park area of Los Angeles. And the controlling gang at the time was 18th Street. The history of MS-13 is really kind of interesting. They started off as a punk rock group. Their first name was MSS, Mara Salvatrucha Stoners, which meant they smoked dope and drank beer and listened to heavy metal music. But because they were working and operating in 18th Street turf at the time, they became natural enemies and natural victims of 18th Street. So 18th Street were picking on them. And they dropped their name, the letter S in their name, and simply became known as Mara Salvatrucha, which really means Salvadorian gang. That's all it is. They were battling each other. Around 1992, there's some anecdotal evidence supported by police intelligence and cases. The Mexican mafia, the prison gang that controls the Southern California Latino gangs that are called Sureños, stepped in there and said, you two are Sureño gangs, you're brother gangs. We don't care if you fight each other, but we're going to divide the turf in half. And 18, you stand this side, and MS stand. When that happened, MS added the number 13 to the back of the name. And the 13 is really significant in the gang world because that's the 13th letter of the alphabet, the letter M. And the way you say that in Spanish is M, and M is the nickname for the Mexican mafia prison gang. Putting a number at the 13 at the end of your gangs solidifies and formally acknowledges that you are an accepted Sureño gang and that you will support the Mexican mafia if you go to prison, which kind of aligned them because they were kind of an outsider brown gang for a while.
So today, the two most notorious gangs in this community are the two you just mentioned?
In California, MS-13, 18th Street. But it depends. L.A. has a lot of old-time gangs there, Garrity, White Fence. We have gangs here, the Lopers, Lowell Street, F-Troopers in Orange County. It varies. But the media has kind of highlighted those two gangs because they claim that they're the largest Hispanic gangs in the country.
You mentioned Orange County gangs. What are the two gangs or three gangs you just mentioned?
Well, we have Lowell Street, Lopers out of Santa Ana, right, F-Troop. We have Brothers from the Hood in Anaheim. Orange County has a number of gangs.
How many members of these gangs?
Well, probably somewhere between 12 and 15,000 gang members in Orange County right now.
Really?
Yeah.
And they account for a large percent of the criminal activity
in
Orange County?
Well, it depends on what city you're in, right? I mean, if we look at the city of Santa Ana, for example, the majority of gangs there are Latino descent. So the majority of gang problems in that city are going to be from Latino or Sureño gangs. Mm-hmm. If you go to Westminster Garden Grove, where there's a large Southeast Asian population and a number of Southeast Asian gangs, the gang crime is committed mostly by them because there's very few Latinos there.
Is it a growing problem?
In my humble opinion, yes, mm-hmm. it's a growing problem. I think that class distinction, racism, and bias really are the three fundamental things of why we have gangs. Historically, this country has had gang behavior since the 1820s. Mm-hmm. The first gangs, as we're all aware, are the Irish street gangs in the Five Point areas of New York. Mm-hmm. And that was a slum area, like some of our neighborhoods are slum areas now. And the Irish were treated totally different. And then the Italians and then the Jews. In fact, the genesis of the Italian mafia, the organized crime, came from the street gangs, the Wyos and Chichesters out of New York, which had Italian members, street gang members, who evolved into what we now know as the La Cosa Nostra organized crime, Italian organized crime.
So as a gang intervention specialist, right, how does one go about tackling that problem?
Well, I don't consider myself a gang intervention specialist. I consider myself somebody who knows a little bit about gangs.
Okay, fair enough.
The true intervention specialists are programs like what the Orange County District Attorney is running, their GRIP program, the OC GRIP program. Anaheim has Anaheim GRIP. City of Fullerton has Full GRIP, where they reach out to the kids at risk in the community and they give them alternatives. What we're finding out is that the gang issues in this country, and especially in this county, are a lot different than originally thought. We thought of 25 years ago. Department of Justice tells us that if you grow up poor and you're a minority in this country and you're young, you have a greater chance of being victimized in a violent crime. And also, those happen to be three major risk factors that can kind of increase the risk of joining a gang. Observing domestic violence at home growing up affects brain development, and you look at life differently. Having a family that's very dysfunctional or a family where the police are always coming in there, you view things differently. In some of our generational gangs that we have here, where we have two and three generations where grandpa and dad and son are members of the same gang, their family views the police as the enemy, as the outsiders, right? You grew up with different mentalities, and what we were forgetting with gangs is that little children mimic parent behaviors. They observe everything. Right? And the best way to highlight it is I have a good psychologist friend of mine, and she loves her husband. She's a great mom, but she has a four-year-old son. And she told me once that her husband has a nasty habit of putting a half glass of milk or a partially drunk glass of milk in a refrigerator, and he always doesn't slide it back on the shelf. And she'd had a very hectic day, a busy day. She opens up the refrigerator, and the glass of milk falls down the floor, and the glass breaks, milk's everywhere, and she goes, mother effer, right? And she's all upset, and she closes the door, and there's her son right there, heard it. And she goes, oh, son, baby, you can't say that. Mommy was bad, does the bad words. And this kid listens, right, and goes, okay, mom, and she's cleaning it up, and she says, mom, can I ask you a question? And she goes, sure, honey, what? Can I say the father part?
Yeah.
And she goes, no, you can't say that. And then he thinks again, and he says, can I just say the F part? And she goes, no, you can't think that again. And here's a great example of how kids listen and mimic parents' behaviors. When parents argue in front of their kids, and dad's calling mom bad words, or dad's hitting bad words, even though the child may not directly observe it, that child hears that. That affects brain development. That does not allow the child to bond with his parents. Statistically speaking, parents talk to their children in this country 8 to 10 minutes a day. How in the heck do you know what your kid's life's about if you talk at them? Clean the house, do the laundry, I'll be home at 6 o'clock, put this in the microwave, watch out for your little brother and sister. Those kids need that ability to talk. And what the GRIP program does in all these counties, what it does is it allows those kids an avenue to come out and talk and what's important to them. And you hear them. The Orange County Department of Education has a restorative practices program, which is absolutely incredible. And the students, all they want to do is decrease absenteeism, expulsions, and suspensions. And they figured out that if kids get to talk with each other, so if bullies get to talk to the victims, and the victims get to tell the bullies how their actions have impacted their lives and how it's damaged their lives, and the bullies tell the victims from their perspective why they're doing, those are not bullies and victims anymore. Because I just heard Friday at a presentation at St. Joe's Hospital, they walk out holding hands. They're buddies because they understand each other.
Yeah.
Because why? Do they get that communication at home? Mm-hmm. The parents of both people showed up, both kids showed up, and were upset initially, but they found out that program works. there's all kind of interventions.
All right, so beautifully. So here's what we're going to do. We're moving so quickly here, and I want to take one 30-second break, April. Get us on some music for 30 seconds. We're coming back. There's a lot more we need to discuss. We needed to discuss the idea that your son was involved in a gang-related shooting.
Yes.
We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about some books that you've authored, including one with Mr. Rene Enriquez, who's in prison, a former Mexican Mafia leader.
Right.
And we're back in 30 seconds, April. This is KX93.5, Laguna's Only FM. All right, a short musical break for us. That's you're listening to KX93.5, Laguna's Only FM. I'm Scott Hayes here with my co-host Jim Bastian. This is OC Caravan, and I'm talking very quickly right now because I want to squeeze in as much information as we can in the remaining time that we have. We're talking here with gang intervention specialist Professor Al Valdez, who teaches over at UCI. We were talking about the gang issues and the gang problems here in Orange County and elsewhere. And I wanted to talk briefly about the idea that 15 years ago, your son was shot by a gang member.
Yeah, my oldest son, Josh, was in the military, stationed at Fort Carson, Colorado. And he was shot in the head by a Latino gang member twice. And he died on the way to the hospital. And the paramedics did what they had to do to bring him back. And he got to the ER, and they realized it was a gunshot wound. And when I got the call on March 9th, 1998, at 2:30 in the morning, you can well imagine it's burnt in. The Army chaplain said my son was seriously injured and I should get to Fort Carson as soon as I can. And that started a long road of recovery and very traumatic events for my life and my family. It was a very terrible incident.
What was the outcome of your son's shooting?
Well, I once said a TED Talk of how you have to forgive and let things go. He's alive. He's made me a grandpa twice. He's a chemical engineer, and he's married to a very wonderful lady, Lourdes, and they live in Orange County. He made it through, but I have to tell you, there were about 3 years of very terrible, painful recovery and physical therapy things he had to go through. And he's never complained. I know he suffers from headaches. He has to walk with a cane now, and he has braces on his bottom part of his legs from his knee down. But for all intents and purposes, he's used that to overcome. He's made lemonade out of lemon.
Was it just a random shooting? It had nothing to do with...
It was a gang-related shooting. He and three other soldiers who were getting promoted had their heads shaved, and they were Latinos. They rented a car and went to an under-21 nightclub to go party, and they drove into a gang fight. And the attacking gang thought they were back up for the victim gang, and the kid went up and shot the vehicle. A couple of soldiers were able to get out. He ducked down in the front seat. He was driving, but the shooter came to the passenger side and let a couple nines go and hit him on top of the head.
When you say soldiers, by the way, we should clarify what you mean by soldiers.
Army soldiers.
There you go.
They were U.S. military soldiers, active duty. They were going to celebrate the fact that they were going to get promoted.
And one last question, and then Jim, is you went through a process yourself of sort of hating and having anger toward those individuals. You eventually came to a point where you could let it go.
Yeah, I had to give a TED Talk to let it go. For years, I planned on killing this kid. Yeah. For years, I had evil thoughts and would spend my time thinking, how to make this right.
Right.
And you have to let it go. You have to forgive. Mm-hmm. And that's easy. Hard.
How did that experience shape your work with gangs in law enforcement?
Well, I think I used it to help me understand from a different perspective what life's all about. I told a professor from Cal State Fullerton yesterday, when we do research and we present our findings, it's sort of a black and white version of a 3D color thing we're looking at, and we lose our humanity. Sometimes in law enforcement, you're so focused on doing your job, you lose the human aspect of it. And people are people. And we have to do a job, but nothing says you can't, to do that job, nothing says you can't do it with respect and a little bit of dignity. And I've used that experience to motivate me to help all the kids I can at UC Irvine to volunteer, to get trained as a sexual assault advocate, a domestic violent advocate. And I encourage everybody to do that. I'm part of the Crisis Response Network for the Orange County Department of Ed. In case, for example, when the teacher terribly committed suicide last week at El Dorado High School, that team went to debrief the children. I think those things are important. I think there's some rules we live by, and I think that's what that incident did. It helped me crystallize the fact that you have to break rules, not laws. You have to believe in yourself. Don't listen to the naysayers. Give back to the community. And most importantly is have lofty goals. Don't be afraid.
So one of the ways you've given back is by writing a number of books.
Yeah.
And I think that's one way that you can extend your teaching more broadly than the classroom. So let's talk about some of the books you've written. You've written one in 2009, Gangs, A Guide to Understanding Street Gangs, Gangs Across America, Histories and Sociology, Urban Street Terrorism, the Mexican Mafia, and Serenos, as you just talked about.
Yeah.
Mexican Mafia, you mentioned earlier the tie between the Mexican Mafia and the gangs in the prison system and the gangs on the street. Talk a little bit about the correlation, if you can, between the Mexican Mafia and the gangs and how that plays out.
In a one-minute caption, the Mexican Mafia, it was California's first prison gang. It's for Latinos. The Mexican Mafia believes it controls all the Southern California Latino gangsters, street gangsters known as Sureños. They view the Sureños as a personal army. So we have a small group of maybe 150 men who think they have an army of 60,000. And the sad part is that some of our street gang members aspire to be Mexican Mafia gang members because it gives them power, gives them the ability over life and death.
So in your book about the Mexican Mafia, your co-author, Rene Enriquez.
Yes.
Talk about him and how you came to know him and write this book.
Actually, I owe that contact to Chris Blatchford, who wrote The Black Hand.
Let me back up a little bit, because I want to give listeners and viewers a sense of who Rene Enriquez is. Yeah. He's a former high-ranking member of the Mexican Mafia. You correct me if I get any of this incorrectly. He spent years in prison for various crimes. He was released in 1989 on parole, and within weeks had committed two murders. He went back to prison and committed more crimes in prison, and he claims to have killed more people than he can remember.
That's what was written in the paper.
Is that an accurate reflection? I don't want to misspeak about what his
I'll tell you, Rene has told me in many conversations that he regrets, but he can't remember everybody that he's hurt.
Okay. And then I interrupted. Jim, back to Jim's question.
So he eventually became an informant for law enforcement.
Right. He was Chris Blatchford reached out to him to do that biography on him. And after the biography was done, he told Chris that he had a little manuscript on the history of the mafia he wanted to write, but he needed help. And Chris and I have been friends for a long time. When my son got shot, the irony of it was I fielded hundreds of phone calls and requests, and people at my door wanted me to do an interview to talk about the irony of a gang investigator's son getting shot by a gang member. Chris Blatchford was the only guy. He sent me a card with a blank check in it and said, go visit your son. Now, we never used a blank check, and he never asked me about it. So I have a tremendous amount of respect for him. We have a sort of unique understanding. He recommended me to Rene, and he called me up, and he said, hey, Rene wants to meet you. He's got this book he wants you to look at. He needs your help writing it. And I hemmed and hawed for a few days. I called Chris back, and I said, okay, give my cell number. And about a week later, I got this cell phone call. And my first contact with Rene was with a cell phone. And I was very, very cautious because this guy's a convicted killer. He's a Mexican Mafia gang member. He's a high-ranking leader. I know that he's ordered the death of people. I know that he's killed people. And I know that he has this, what he calls this alpha male arrogance to it. And he had kind of an arrogant tone when he was talking. Even though he's in prison, he was humble, but he still had this arrogant tone. But I was intrigued with the idea. So I agreed to meet him, and over a period of 2 years, we wrote the book. We're working on the second edition right now.
The name of the book, by the way, is Gangs Across America, History and Sociology, Second Edition, yes?
That's my book, Rene's book.
That's your book?
Yeah.
And then Rene's, the other one is Urban Street Terrorism, the Mexican Mafia, and the, pronounce that word for me? Sureños. Written with you and Rene Enriquez. What was that moment like when you came to have this phone call with this person who is a high-ranking Mexican Mafia member, and how did that play with your ideas of being an educator, a law enforcement person, working in close proximity, I guess, to this person.
Personally, I had a little bit of the dilemma, to be honest with you. I despise people who hurt people.
Yeah.
And I did 28 years of helping put people like him in prison and hold them accountable for their actions. I was also, the academic side, very curious because I thought here's a rare opportunity as an academic to look at the inside world of this criminal organization and maybe help understand further what's going on with street gangs and the influence on street gangs. So when I met Renee, I met him at a jail. I had to travel to several jails throughout California to meet him. He wasn't ever the same place at once and always escorted. He was very polite. He was always been very polite to me, but he always had sort of an arrogant and confidence to him that made me feel a little bit uncomfortable. As I got to know him more and more and more, that uneasy feeling went away, but it was still the law enforcement training. You know, he's dangerous. Stay away from him. He's dangerous. But over the last 4 years, I saw something I never thought I would see that my academic training allowed me to see. He's changed. He's mellowed out. He wants to do what he calls pro-social work. He's helped and trained thousands of police officers. He works with the FBI. He's done a lot of good things. Now, I'm not a judge, and I don't think any of our listeners can tell you whether he's done enough to repay the fact that he's hurt people and killed, too. I don't know. The parole board and the state psychologists determined that he did, and I trust them. The governor overruled them as he has the opportunity to. It's a shame that I think society can't forgive sometimes, but this man has truly changed. I saw him about 60 days ago when I brought an official from the Canadian Immigration who wanted to ask him some questions about Sureño and mafia activity in Canada. And he'd put on a little weight. He had removed his tattoos. In the book, The Black Hand, you'll see a picture of Rene. He's got a black hand, a tattoo of a black hand over his heart. That's the symbol of the mafia. That's his calling card. Rene once told me that he really enjoyed walking in the yard, the prison yard, without a shirt on because everybody would see that black hand. And he says, parting of the waters, like the Red Sea. All the Sureños would part because he was somebody of authority. He had power. He was important. Well, the very first tattoo he had removed was what? The black hand, which is, from a psychological perspective, huge. He was killing the old Rene and trying to get reborn as the new Rene from a psychological perspective. The general public might not understand that. People in law enforcement might understand it. From a psychologist's point of view, that is a major, major breakthrough. And the unique thing is when I saw him about 60 days ago, he told me he heard I was granted parole. I said, yes, I wish you the best of luck. I said, you still know the governor can overturn this. We've got to wish for the best, but prepare for the what, Rene? And he said, the worst, and he had tears in his eyes. His eyes welled up. And that was huge. I told the immigration official from Canada that you just witnessed a breakthrough. And they said, what do you mean? I said, the man is showing emotion. Here's a man who had no emotion 10, 15 years ago, now showing emotion, now showing remorse, a total change. Now, is he a good actor? I don't know. Is he faking me? I don't know. I'm just reporting what I saw. Mm-hmm. And to me, as a psychologist, those are huge changes that people change. So we just have to wait and see if he gets parole.
How old of a man is he?
He's 50.
There was this discussion to release him from prison because of the value that he brought to law enforcement agencies and others into the insights of various criminal activities. Eventually, Governor Jerry Brown blocked his release from prison, citing security reasons, saying specifically, this is from the news reports, the evidence shows that he currently poses an unreasonable danger to society. He has been targeted by criminals. His release would pose serious security risks to him, his family, his parole agent, and to the community. I'm wondering what your thinking is on his release from prison.
That is partially true, because he's a dropout and he's personally helped dismantle the operations of the Mexican mafia throughout the United States. He's in what they call the green light list, which is a hit list. And he's marked for hard candy, which is the Mexican mafia term for death. So he is on the list, and that's why they've moved him from jail to jail, prison to prison, to keep him hidden. He is. If he got out, he obviously would be in the witness protection program by the feds. He'd get a different identity, maybe some facial changes, I don't know. And you wouldn't know who he was. But the issue is his face and his images have been portrayed in the media and on the internet it would be easy to identify him.
And he teaches with you sometimes via Skype, correct?
Yeah, he did it once. Yeah, at the University of Skype. His schedule has not permitted it, so I used some pre-recorded interviews he gave me for the classes now. But he did it once in Skype.
You're still in contact with him? You still discuss things such as the book and other things, right?
Right. Yeah, I haven't been able to talk to him because when this thing broke about the parole and the Times released their article about 3 weeks ago, the state came back and hooked him up and took him. I don't know where he's at right now.
And so from your perspective as a UCI professor, as a gang intervention specialist, as a person who's written a book with Mr. Enriquez, do you believe he should have been released from prison?
My faith is in the parole board and the state psychologists. I have seen some changes. I may be snookered, but I believe in his changes, and I wouldn't have opposed his release with special conditions. As long as he's continuing to see a psychologist and he's getting psychological help, as long as he abides by the rules of parole and he abides by the rules of the witness protection program, I don't think it would be a danger.
And what do you believe brought on the changes in him?
You know, he will tell you that partly it's because of me, and I don't think it's because of me. I didn't do anything profound for him. All I did was open some doors for him, and he happened to look through the doors and look at his life from a different perspective. I told him once that if you were on this side of the fence, you would be the CEO of a Fortune 500 company right now. You don't have a formal high school education, yet you speak like a Fortune 500 CEO. You use $30 vocabulary words. You're a self-educated man. You could have done something. And he goes, no, I know. I made poor decisions. I made really poor decisions, and I was rebelling against my dad. If you read the book, his home life was not really cool. He had a dad that was overly strict and a mom that was overly gentle. So you had two ends of a spectrum, and that doesn't cause for a really good functional family, right? A lot of conflict. His older brother was a gang member, so he used his older brother as a mentor. I mean, things happen that explain. We're not excusing anything he does. We just want to understand why people do that. It goes back to why we keep kids out of gangs, why the GRIP programs are so important, and programs are like that so important, because guys like Renee won't end up in prison. And here's a really sad fact. Here's a really sad fact. If you look at the males in prison today, in California State Prison, 76% of them, the very first time they got in trouble was for truancy. Hmm. So there's a direct pipeline from school to our California prisons. And that's what these programs try to prevent, break that pipeline. And Renee was in that pipeline.
We got about 2 minutes. We're talking about the book, Urban Street Terrorism, the Mexican Mafia, and the Sorenos. And I'm wondering, this is a very quick question, quick answer. Do you have any concerns for your own life having written a book about the inner workings of a gang like the Mexican Mafia?
No.
None at all?
No.
Yeah? And then here's another question. We've got about 2 minutes, and that is, you're a gang intervention specialist, and you just got through telling us a story about your son who was shot by some gang members. And that process of years you had to go through to sort of purge the anger and the resentment and the hatred for those two people who shot your son. And you came to a place where you could let it go and forgive.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what you would say to the families of the victims, Mr. Enriquez, to help them sort of overcome some of those same feelings they may still hold on to today. How would you advise them to get through that?
The grief response varies from people, and it takes time. I had to deal with my own demons, and they're going to have to deal with their own demons. I, as a police officer, gave death notifications. That's the worst job anybody could have, is knocking on somebody's house at 3 a.m. to let them know that their son or daughter or loved one is dead. And I don't care if they were a gang member or not, they were still somebody's son or daughter, somebody that was loved. And to see how these people process it, and you have to catch them when they're fainting and the wailing and crying, and then trying to hook them up with a victim witness advocate to help them. I appreciated that. I really did. But until I was one of those folks when my kid got shot, I never had a true understanding of how difficult it is to get over that. I understand the anger. I totally understand and accept people who don't want to forgive. But if you want to get on in life, if you want to continue to do good things and not wallow in the past, you have to be able to let that go. I have a good friend of mine in Dallas-Fort Worth. Her 16-year-old son was murdered for a $200 stereo, and she runs an anti-violence program over there. And she's the one that I spoke to many times about my demons, because she also told me that she wanted to kill the 16-year-old kid who shot her kid. She shot for years. Her marriage she got divorced over it. Her husband couldn't process it. She's a violence prevention advocate now in Texas now. And she also confided that she wanted to kill her son. And then when I told her, God, I'm not weird, she kind of validated me by accident. And when I go back to the Dallas-Fort Worth area to do training there, I always have time to have a lunch or a dinner with this lady because we are sort of comrades in the same thing. She still gets over it. This is a bad week for me. This is March 9th. This is 17th year. You can't forget that. The victims that Renee killed, their family can't forget that. But if you let it go, you can go forward. That's part of healing. You got to be able to let it go.
Did you forgive the two gang members who shot your son?
Yeah, in my mind I did. I'm still angry at them. I still hate that they hurt my kid. Probably took about 20 years of his life away because he's not going to live full life expectancy and he's having problems. He has headaches and he falls down. But he's maybe a grandpa twice.
And you believe Mr. Enriquez deserves forgiveness as well?
I think society should forgive. But who determines whether the payment he's made is enough to take to pay for what he's done?
You're listening to gang intervention specialist Al Valdez, UCI professor. This is OC Caravan. You've been listening to KX93.5 FM. Al, thank you so much
for
coming
in
and being so forthcoming with all your information.
We
appreciate it. Jim, any last thoughts? We got to go?
No, we're good.
Okay, April, take us out of here with a little music, please.